Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.
Nous recevons aujourd'hui Jeremy Heil, astrophysicien, professeur et directeur du département de physique et d'astronomie de l'Université de la Colombie-Britannique au Canada, à Vancouver. Spécialiste des objets compacts, naines blanches, étoiles à neutrons, trous noirs, il travaille sur les zones les plus extrêmes du cosmos, là où matière, lumière et gravitation entrent dans des régimes qui défient nos représentations. Avec lui, nous interrogeons ce que signifie réel lorsque l'échelle cosmique agit comme un révélateur ou un perturbateur de notre sensibilité. Nous parlerons de son parcours, de sa pratique de chercheur et de la manière dont on apprend à écouter un univers qui ne se donne jamais directement. La semaine prochaine, nous poursuivrons cet échange avec Jeremy Heil pour explorer les dimensions plus conceptuelles et philosophiques de l'astrophysique, comment la notion même de la réalité se reconfigure à l'échelle des objets compacts, comme la science produit des images, simulations, mesures, modèles, qui ne sont jamais des simples représentations mais des interprétations actives du réel. Cette seconde partie sera suivie d'une écolalia, une radiopeinture inspirée de cette conversation.
That, so she doesn't get tangled up.
Yeah.
Okay.
First of all, thank you so much for receiving me here.
You're welcome.
In your office. So that's the Physics and Astronomy Building of UBC.
It's the Hennings Building. It's okay. The Physics and Astronomy Department, even though a lot of the signs say physics, but they merged in the late 1990s. Okay. So they moved astronomers over into physics about then. There were a few astronomers here, radio astronomers, but then they put everybody together at that point and created new departments. As universities do, they like to rearrange things.
And what are you? You're an astronomer?
I'm an astronomer. I'm mainly a high-energy astrophysicist. So, astrophysics, I mean, a lot of people do it. You don't have to specialize too much, a lot, because just the data keeps increasing, you know, sort of every 10 years we have about 10 times more data, so you know it's always good to be agile. So
what does this mean exactly? So when you're you're a trained physicist and
all of my degrees are in astronomy or in astrophysics.
Astrophysics is still physics.
It every place I've been it's a separate department except here.
So I
was in the department of, I guess they called it astrophysical sciences as an undergraduate, and it turned out just from a quirk of fate, I was the only one to finish in my year, but typically it was only a few people, and then I was in the Institute of Astronomy, and then a department of astronomy and astrophysics or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's never been pure physics.
But when you start studying, you
study physics. Yeah, but I just like to underline, especially with my more physics-y faculty, I'm like, I don't have any degrees in physics.
And when you say you're an astronomer, what does that mean?
Well, I study stars mainly, so that's good for astronomer. I'm not, at least right now in my stage, I'm not doing understanding galaxies or cosmology, the universe as a whole. So I study stars, but also the remnants of the evolution of stars. So I kind of study both. except right now my focus is running this thing, but a lot of my focus is on the remnants of stars, the dead stars, so specifically neutron stars, and then also white dwarf stars, which are sort of, the white dwarfs are the stars, what stars like our sun will become, so they're the most common remnants out there, and they're probably, you know, one of the most common stars out in the universe, because lots of stars have died up till this time, right? And 90% of stars that have died will be white dwarfs, not these more exotic things. So that's what I study. But then, especially with the white dwarfs, you know, how they get produced and what we can learn of them relies on understanding all the evolution up to when they become a white dwarf as well. Neutron stars get born in supernova, and that's kind of a big, very dramatic event and makes a supernova remnant, and they're especially rare. So in a certain sense, since they are formed in such a cataclysmic thing, that sort of, it becomes less interesting where they came from, because a lot of that is erased in a sense. And we don't necessarily understand that process very well, which is part of why we study white dwarfs, in that there we can trace them back to their birthplaces. We can kind of figure it out. You know, if I look at a given white dwarf, how big was the star it came from, by figuring out where it was born. And then that helps us figure out what's the most massive type of star that will make a white dwarf, which is important, because that tells you the ones more massive make these exotic things and have supernova explosions and all this other mm-hmm. stuff. And that threshold we don't even understand. Like, if I look at a star like that's around 10 times the mass of the sun, mm-hmm. the theorists would say, oh, that'll make a neutron star and have a supernova explosion. I would say, well, maybe not, because my group has found white dwarfs that were born from stars nearly that massive. So it ends up that's one of the puzzles that we're looking at. And it's fun because, I mean, neutron stars I've been studying for a long time, and they're incredibly rare. They're incredibly faint. There's hard to get a lot of data from them, whereas white dwarfs are everywhere, not the closest star, but if you look out in the sky, the brightest star in the night sky is called Sirius, mm-hmm. and it's not very far away, and it has a white dwarf companion, and another bright, and Sirius is the dog star, and people might not know that. And it's in a constellation called Canis Major. And it's in front of Orion. So Orion's there, the hunter. And in front is the big dog mm-hmm. with Sirius. And in front of the big dog is the little dog, Canis Minor, who also, its brightest star is called Procyon, who also has a white dwarf companion. So these are just, they're just out there, and they're very common. So all of these stars that I'm referring to are in our immediate neighborhood, meaning within, you know, Sirius isn't the closest star to Earth after the sun, for sure, but it might be the fifth or sixth closest star. And if you were to look among the closest stars, just ones that are wandering around, there are white dwarfs that are on their own, too. So that's one aspect, and the other aspect is the neutron stars, which I've been working on because, there's a lot of exotic phenomenon that's going on there. They have very strong magnetic fields, so that lets us test sort of fundamental things about quantum field theory. Their insides, we think, are superfluid and superconducting. So when I go down to QMI, I'm like, well, you know, my matter is a lot more condensed than yours. But it's also at nuclear density as well. So this is probing nuclear physics in a sense, too. And we have, on both the white dwarfs and the neutron stars, we get thermonuclear explosions depending on if they're accreting from a companion. So that also helps us test or think about nuclear physics as well. So there's a whole lot of different niches of physics that one can get into by looking at these objects, because they're sort of quite extreme. It's just one are a lot more extreme in that, you know, they're the mass of the sun compressed into something about 12 kilometers in radius. So whereas if it were a black hole, that would be about, let me think, can't do the math in my head, about 3 kilometers in radius. So they're very close to being on the border of collapsing into a black hole. Whereas the white dwarf, it's fine. It's about the size of the Earth and the mass of the sun. So clearly it's a lot more dense. But in the process of looking for these white dwarfs that have escaped from their birthplaces, we found a white dwarf that's a little bit bigger than the moon. Found a few of them. So very much more massive and much smaller, and, you know, just on the edge of stability to collapse into, well, probably a neutron star. But that's another thing that people don't know, like what happens when this very, very massive white dwarf, you know, if it manages to get over its maximum limit. The less massive ones, when they, if they accrete a lot, they explode and make a type of supernova. But these guys are so massive, they don't have that much nuclear energy available to them to explode anymore. So they would just go into a neutron star. So these are kind of the areas that I'm exploring. But the thing with looking for the white dwarfs is we look for them in clusters. And clusters, like you can see these pictures, are really, really pretty. And in fact, in at least the one in the left, if you look up there, you can find the white dwarfs just with your eye, in that they're not the bright white stars, but if you look in there, they're little blue ones that are really blue, like the Eeyore, that you can see in the image. I think you can see it in that image, if not, then the one in the, And in general, that what's neat about doing this is that you can just you can get so much out of those images, right? It's just we really just are taking a picture of a cluster in two bands, so that's really a two color image. If you look at the one on the right, you can see there's a lot of white in there. That's because that's constructed from a three-color image, so we can actually make white. Whereas the one on the left, the third color is just kind of faked, because otherwise, well, you can see everything kind of looks kind of purpley, because the two ones are red. The two colors that are real on the one on the left are the red one and the blue one, and the middle green is kind of faked, whereas on the right we have three different bands that have been put together. But the point is just looking, and I mean, you don't do it with your eye, but with my eye, you know, I can easily pick out the white dwarfs in those images, and that tells us, like the one on the, well, both of them, they tell us about how the cluster, these clusters sort stars out by their mass, so we can see, you know, the more massive stars are in the middle and the less massive stars are further out. And these white dwarfs probe that process. They also probe, like, how many neutrino species are there, or is there an axion, which is another hypothetical, well, neutrino isn't a hypothetical particle, but the axion's a hypothetical particle. Because we can see how the white dwarfs are cooling with time. Mm-hmm. Because basically we see, it's sort of like these clusters are, if you imagine, if we had in both these clusters, the stars that are going through or finishing their lives are a little bit less massive than the sun. And some of them are a little bit more massive, some are a little less, and the ones that are more massive are further along in their life cycle. So basically, by looking at the cluster, you can see, you're kind of seeing all the stages of stars' evolution, like a movie, except you see all the frames of the movie at once. So you don't have to wait for the end. You can see the end, which is looking at the white dwarfs, the faintest ones, or stars that died a very long time ago. And then you can look at the stars that are dying today, which in those images would be bright and red. And you see a lot of them in there. And then you can see stars that are kind of weird in that they're bright and they're blue or bluey white. And those are stars that kind of ate a companion star and became a bigger star, and we call them blue stragglers. But you can just see them from your eye. Of course, that's not how we analyze them, but it's kind of it's nice to just, it makes it tangible, even though it's, you know, thousands of light years away.
And on a daily basis, how do you proceed? So when do you go sometimes to a place where the telescopes are, or do you just ask people to make photographs and send them to you?
Well, for the most part, how it works, I mean, ask in the sense that we propose for telescope time, and then that's awarded. And for the most part, most telescopes that are sort of available nationally, which are the ones that we have access to mainly, you don't physically go there anymore, and your observations are just scheduled at some optimum time in relation to the other observations that are going on. So typically our programs that we're running on ground-based telescopes will require a few hours of telescope time at once. So it would make little sense to give us an entire night or for us to go to where it is. And typically we get our observations. The ones that we propose for are coming from Hawaii or from Chile, so the Gemini telescopes. Some of our collaborators, they have access to the Keck telescopes, and the Keck is set up differently in that that you get the whole night if you propose, and then it's up to you to schedule observations.
Where are these?
The Keck is a pair of telescopes also on Mauna Kea that are mainly, they're co-owned by Caltech and the University of California. And so there, that's kind of interesting, because then what happens is, well, Caltech, in fact, has the Keck telescope plus also telescopes near San Diego that are also quite big, where also you get the night. And I don't think you physically have to go anymore, but there's the option, but you operate it on the computer. And there, in those cases, you schedule the whole night, but also if you know someone who has a night, you can say, hey, you want to grab this or that for me, because usually they are kind of, will use stuff to fill up their time, right? So if they have time, they'll grab your object. And often our objects are kind of bright, so you would do that at the beginning of the night or the end of the night when the sky is not great yet and it doesn't matter to us. So there's a bit of that where you kind of ask around, and you might not get that time, but that, that kind of helps as well. And then a lot of the observations that are done from space. So those two images up there are from the Hubble Space Telescope, where you make up a proposal and you hope to get awarded the time. And typically that happens on a time scale of about a year, like the cycling. And of course, we don't go up to the Hubble to get that data. That just
who are the persons in, like, who are the people in charge at the telescope? So they're astronomers as well, and they're on there on a yearly basis, or
So like who's physically at the observatory?
And
at
Hubble.
So there'll be people who kind of run the operation, and there'll be some astronomers involved with that, but also a lot more technical people, whether it's Hubble or whether it's ground-based telescope. And there'll be people based locally at in Hawaii or in Chile, as well as people For example, for Gemini, there'll be people involved with Gemini that are based over in Victoria, which is where the sort of national observatory is. And then there's the whole management and who chooses. So basically, you know, every 6 months for a ground-based telescope, I guess about every year for the space-based, people propose for time. They strike a committee or many committees who kind of rank these proposals in order of priority and decide who gets the time. So that's how those operate. So on the flip side, you know, I've been involved on and off for about 20 years with what's called X-ray polarimetry, meaning the measurement of polarization of light in the X-rays from mainly neutron stars and black holes. And in about 5 years ago, or a little less than 5 years ago, 4 years ago, a little less than four, a satellite was launched called IXPE, Imaging X-ray Polarimetric Explorer. So that's kind of a different system, or at least during the first couple of years, because there were a whole bunch of maybe about 100 people who invested a lot of time into getting this to happen. And then once it was launched, those people had about a year or so just to decide within that group what we're going to observe and how and so on. And then after that initial period, then it goes into this mode of everyone can apply for time and figure it all out. So that's been kind of extraordinary in that, you know, during that first year, practically every week or so, there'd be entirely new data that, you know, one could choose to contribute to understand or not. And then because the satellite was doing something essentially new, you actually had no idea what was going to be in there because no one had done observations like these before. So you were just looking at it in a whole new way. So that's been really exciting. And also what was also nice about it is because it was the first time through, you know, you're just looking at objects that are quite well known, but in a completely different way. So that was kind of really a lot of fun. So it's sort of like, and you know, people have been doing things. It was maybe a factor of 1,000 or 10,000 more sensitive than anything that had happened before. So it meant you had gone from like looking at the sun to actually looking at stars and neutron stars in this way, sort of. So, you know, you're seeing hundreds or thousands of different objects and getting this sort of information where all before you could see was the sun, which is good, right? So that's kind of, you know, opening up a new frontier, which has been, although it's sort of inevitably that, you know, your ideas aren't right. So you have to kind of, some ideas have proven right, and that just helps you think about what's going on even better.
And how do you imagine the future of astronomy? I mean, has been so much new possibilities within your professional lifetime. I mean, it's incredible how technology finally opens doors, but one has to follow as well and must be able to interpret everything. So
yeah, it's just that you have to be getting better and better at handling large amounts of data. You also have the computers who are getting much, much faster at handling large amounts of data. So sort of things that would, at my beginning of my career, that would take hours or days, of course, now take seconds, which means you just have to be sort of better organized about what you want to do. But also, in a lot of ways, you know, when the computation was limited, you would be looking for shortcuts, and often finding those shortcuts is difficult. Whereas when the computation is, you know, sometimes there's obviously an optimal way of doing things. It's just costly. Although now it's that cost is not that important, right? So one, you know, one can just do it 100% properly and not worry about, well, what corners did I need to cut to get to that conclusion?
Did you feel ever completely lost in your research? I mean, completely disoriented and saying, okay, maybe it's all wrong. Maybe it's
like, oh, well, that happens all the time, right? Is it because like so? But often when you're wrong, it just means that. Well, you might have thought that the universe is like it's not going to cooperate with us. That's what I always find amusing. Like when you read. You know, like a detective book, right? Which I enjoy reading, but it's completely contrived in that, of course, the author knows what the answer is and puts in the clues along the way. So it's a little bit different than true crime, where, you know, you're finding the clues along the way and maybe you don't come to a conclusion. But in both those cases, they're humans dealing with humans. So you have a sense of what's human nature and whatnot. Whereas our mysteries are just like, they're not about us. And there may not be any clues at all to figuring it out. Or there might be. Or there might be clues that we don't even know that they're clues and we don't understand. Because we're not dealing with anything in our everyday experience, really. So that makes it quite interesting. And then you just have to be open to be like, well, you try to understand all the possibilities ahead of time.
Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.